Welcome to Dangerous Wisdom, a journey into mystery and a gateway to the mind of nature and the nature of mind. This is Dr. Nikos, your friendly neighborhood soul doctor, happy to be here with you so that together we can create a culture of wisdom, love, and beauty. Auspicious interbeing to you and yours, my friends, Koinos Hermes, and a deep bow to Sophia as always. My friends, very special guest today. We have a spiritual pioneer with us. And if you've listened to other episodes, you might know the deep connection between philosophers and priestesses and philosophy and magic, and we will get into that a little bit more. But I wanted to introduce our guest first. Phyllis Curat is an attorney, writer, and one of America's first public witches. Her international best-selling memoir, Book of Shadows, five other books, and groundbreaking Witches' Wisdom Tarot have been published in 14 languages, making her the most widely published Wiccan author in the world. And I haven't read all her material, but I do encourage you to check out Book of Shadows. It's a delightful read, and maybe we'll talk a little bit about it. She is an outspoken advocate in the courts and media. She handled or consulted on groundbreaking cases securing the legal rights of witches, including cases of child custody, religious assembly, organization, expression, and free speech. Phyllis was named one of the 10 gutsiest women of the year by Jane Magazine and inducted into the Martin Luther King Jr. Collegium of Clergy and Scholars. She received the 2018 Service to Humanity Award from the One Spirit Interfaith Seminary and the 2020 Person of the Year Award from Kindred Spirit. Phyllis is a trustee of the Parliament of World's Religions, serving as vice chair of the 2015 Parliament and program chair for the historic 2021 Parliament, blessed by Pope Francis, and the 2023 Parliament with its theme of religious responsibility to resist the growing scourge of fascism. New York Magazine has called her teaching on witchcraft the culture's next big idea, and Time Magazine has published her as one of America's leading thinkers. Her YouTube series on Wicca has almost 3 million views. Phyllis is teaching online and working on her next book on the embodied spiritual wisdom of Mother Earth, nature's secret magic, and why the world needs its witches. We'll have some links in the show notes. Phyllis Curat, welcome to Dangerous Wisdom, my friend.
Real, genuine pleasure to be here. And I love the way you began with the note about the relationship between philosophers and priestesses.
Indeed. And for those who don't know, so Phyllis was asking me at the beginning, now, why did you want to talk to me? And some of you may know, of course, that Socrates pleaded ignorance on everything, except one thing. There was one thing that he said he knew a little bit about, and that was love. And in the Symposium, he tells us that the reason he knows about it is that he was initiated by a priestess from Mantinea, Diotima. Now, Mantinea has a double meaning in a way. It would have evoked in the Greek ear mantic, as in chiromancy or geomancy. That is the reading of the future, right? So chiromancy is palm reading. Geomancy is reading signs in the earth. And so it would have evoked that sense of prophecy. And it also would have evoked a part of the world which considered itself the indigenous Greeks. So the place Mantinea, where she was from, would have been, those people would have thought of themselves as the oldest of the Greek peoples. And so there's this beautiful thing that happened that got lost, that Plato was still working in a tradition where a philosopher was much closer to the way Phyllis, I think, will describe witches than anything we would see in the university. And there's probably a sense for some people connected to those ancient traditions that that Socrates might be disappointed by university philosophy in a lot of ways. But Phyllis studied philosophy. And so, of course, I'm always interested in speaking to priestesses and witches, and I was looking for different people, and I contacted a few academics, but I thought, now I want to talk to a real good practicing witch. And when I found you, I said, well, this is perfect. And then I started reading your book, and it's so cool. Book of Shadows is just such, it's beautifully written, and it's just a wonderful journey. I really encourage people, read that book. It's a really delightful book. Okay, so that's why I wanted to talk to you. And so now let's talk. Can we start with your journey? How in the world did a woman who studied philosophy at Brown, which is not at all anywhere near the old school way, and then went to law school, and then you became a witch? This is incredible.
It was, yeah, ridiculous. It was not like in the yearbook of the plan. It wasn't the plan. At least it wasn't my conscious plan, but it was certainly what was meant to be. Yeah, I was a philosophy major at Brown, specifically in the area of ethics and political philosophy. And honestly, I felt like I was running as fast as I could to keep up, and felt that it was always just, the point of it all was sort of eluding me. I felt immersed in a kind of deliberately constructed maze that the walls of which were a kind of intellectual infatuation and ego and competitiveness. And I mean, the point of it all was the pursuit of wisdom, but it seemed, I don't know, it seemed that that was what we were supposed to be doing, but not what we were actually doing. And I gravitated over to the work of Professor Duncan Smith, who was in the German Civ department. And that's where I found myself really engaged and fascinated. And he was working specifically in the area of Marxist aesthetics, about which people know, I mean, you know, could it get more bizarre, weird, obscure? Yes, that would be witchcraft. But his work was kind of about the political and philosophical manuscripts of 1844, so before Das Kapital and the economic theories. And the focus was on the relationship between I and thou, between you and I. And what dwells in that mysterious space between us? And how do we engage one another? And why do we engage one another? And of course, there was a whole idea of the influence of the world in which we live, the reality of the world in which we live, how people make a living, how people treat one another in that realm, and the powerful influence that has on everything. So he was moving in the direction of economic theory, but the focus was still very numinous and kind of liminal, that liminal place. And I was fascinated. And Marcuse really resonated for me, Eros and Civilization in particular. That's where I spent my time. But I was still interested in how one could implement philosophy, right? So that it's not just theory, but praxis. And that was why I became a lawyer. And I became a social justice lawyer. I began by fighting organized crime and trade unions. But in that period of training as an attorney, still in theoretically in pursuit of wisdom and questioning and how one tries to come to the truth in that context, within the framework of jurisprudence, of she with the blindfold and the scales, I started having extraordinary experiences that I wrote about in Book of Shadows. And I had no framework for them because I was too young for the psychedelic 60s. I lived and grew up in New York and went to Brown, you know, on the East Coast. I missed the whole thing. I had practiced yoga for quite a number of years when I was young. And that had been a powerful set of embodied experiences. But, you know, I didn't really have a framework. And being pretty hyper-rational, and sort of social, everything was oriented towards sort of social forces and historic forces and economic forces and the sense of responsibility that one should have, you know, to make of the world a better place, at least for each other. I went to rational explanations for these very non-rational experiences of intuition, dreams, sensitivity, knowing that had no rational explanation, and that were accurate, were predictive, were correct, right? That would come true. And so I went to quantum physics. And here were the law books, and right next to them, you know, was quantum physics, which sort of led into some of the Friedrich Capra and larger thinking and the idea of consciousness in its most expanded capacities and ability to know beyond the limitations of what we are taught, we're able to know. I still had no explanation for why things were happening. You know, what was the point of it all? And I was led by synchronicities and signs and circumstances and friendship into the last place, and certainly the most irrational place one could ever go, and that was a hidden coven of witches in New York City, and all women. So it was a bit radical, very quite. And but being a second wave feminist, I was like, oh, okay. I was offered an opportunity. I turned it down, of course, because they were witches. I mean, it was mad. And then I had an experience with which I couldn't possibly argue, which was the materialization of a figure who had appeared to me several times during that period in law school, where basically this shamanic break had begun. And she materialized in the figure of a statue called the Libyan Sibyl at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. She had been carved by William Wetmore Story, who was an attorney, in fact, and kind of part of the transcendentalist movement that the broad, wealthy Brahmins of Boston. His father was a Supreme Court judge, which was my father's aspiration for me. Didn't work out. And he had gone to Rome in the mid-1800s, as people did, you know, for the Grand Tour, and he stayed and became a sculptor. And he had a visit from Harriet Beecher Stowe, none of which I knew at the time, but all of which I learned years later, about this statue. I could find nothing about her at the time. But she was the embodiment of inspiration he'd received listening to Harriet Beecher Stowe talk to him when she was on the Grand Tour and visited him at his studio, about listening to Sojourner Truth give a speech. And what appeared in his imagination after that conversation, and they were, you know, it was a powerful intersection of spirituality, of progressive spirituality in a sense, right? And politics, because they were the suffragettes, they bred the suffragette movement, and the abolitionist movement that they were, and also public education and a lot of stuff. And he crafted this statue called the Libyan Sibyl. And it was the figure that had been appearing in my dream. So I had quite a moment in seeing her materialized in front of me, which I recounted in Book of Shadows. And I knew the word Sibyl meant something magical, but I wasn't quite sure what. I went home to my little tiny, teeny tiny, itty bitty, one bedroom little studio apartment in New York City, and with my Oxford English edition, you know, the annotated edition, because that was all I could fit into the space, but it was enormous. I pulled out the magnifying glass, I put on my glasses, I looked up Sibyl, and it said, an ancient prophetess, a witch. And I was, I'm not going to argue with this. So I made my way back to the esoteric bookstore, which was the home of this coven, and began to attend every week. And they whittled the number down from 40, 50 women of all shapes, sizes, ages, races, everything down to eight of us. And announced that we were a coven. It took a couple of months. When they announced we were a coven, I almost ran out the door. But the unmaking of language and all the stuff that attends, right, those highly charged words, which have for hundreds of years kept us separated from the truth of our indigenous wisdom traditions, and have kept women separated from their spiritual wisdom, their power, their capacities, their roles as priestesses, who were prophetesses, who did indeed engage in prophecy, the capacity to know beyond rational means, to see clearly, using modes of consciousness that are innate and a part of who we are, but which have been suppressed, forgotten, neglected, denied, refused, and made dangerous and endangering of those who practice them. And in their company, I began to find that the things that were happening spontaneously could be experienced through the cultivation of a spiritual technology that would actually work to open the mind and to allow one to know truth beyond the rational modality that I had been rigorously trained in. And that was very powerful for me. And simultaneously, I began working in the very first drumming group to come out of the academic teaching of Michael Harner, Dr. Michael Harner, who was the head of the graduate division of the anthropology department at the New School. And a few of his students, one of my dearest friends, Dr. Lorenzo Menegoni, who was there in his PhD program, and a few others, had decided to implement the teaching that he was doing of the use of steady percussive rhythm to alter consciousness, which is a universal technique, a spiritual technology used by indigenous peoples all over the globe, including our European and our Hellenic and our Egyptian. The priestesses entered the temples in Egypt rattling as they moved. And that steady percussive rhythm, turns out, the rational mind being useful, we wouldn't be doing this without it. So, not to denigrate it too much, but you have to have balance. Years ago, there were a number of tests that were done. I don't think they've proceeded sufficiently in continuing to sort of understand what is actually happening. But we do know that the mind responds to steady percussive rhythm of about 200 beats a minute by altering the brainwave. It produces a theta wave, which is a longer, slower, deeper wave than alpha, which is what you get in most states of meditation. And it's a visionary state. And it was used for very practical purposes, diagnosing illness and figuring out, where to go hunt or where you'd find water in a tribal culture, but also used for ecstatic and sacred purposes, for encountering the numinous, for engaging with spirit. And I think, with profound results. And so I merged those two things very early on and found it a very fruitful union and continued on because the proof is in the pudding. And I learned how to cook. So, I kind of like the rational following in the footsteps of it's not irrational, it's the non-rational, right? It's modes of perception that are intuitive and instinctive and extraordinary. And when the rational follows, the experience is not negated, but usually confirmed. And we're able to go further into the reality in our pursuit of wisdom. I think we can go further than the rational mind has allowed us in many ways. It certainly hasn't been really good at understanding sacred wisdom or understanding the earth, ironically. We're better served with other faculties. So I'll stop there because obviously I could go.
Sure.
So
Well, okay.
philosophy, the pursuit, the love of wisdom, right? And our culture has been infatuated with the rational mind. And the rational mind is an extraordinary thing, mysterious, but phenomenal. But the combination of sort of patriarchy, of male making of culture to the exclusion of female participation, the power of testosterone and ego, the infatuation with the rational mind, and the suppression of our instinct and our intuition, the denial of bodily wisdom, of earthly wisdom, of embodied wisdom, even of spiritual wisdom, really, has brought us to the brink of extinction. So the world needs her witches. The world needs fully human humans, not half humans.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a lot to reflect on in all that you're sharing there. I mean, for one thing, there is a deep question about what we can mean by intelligence. Dewey, the philosopher Dewey, who was in his own way kind of mystical, but certainly much more holistic thinker, said that he tried to give us a sense of intelligence as transcending what we refer to as reason. He was very deliberate about that. He said, look, when I'm talking about intelligence, it's not just what we have traditionally called reason. So he sensed that there was something holistic. I think it's difficult territory to move into, though, for us, because we don't realize how much we get infected with conquest consciousness and certain style of thinking and style of consciousness. Because naively, we think consciousness is just consciousness. I'm conscious. We don't realize that no, you're conscious based on a developmental path, and that limits what you will be conscious of and how you'll relate, right? But you were able to, what was so interesting about the story, and this has happened before. We've had a few people, we had a neuroscientist, another philosopher, who had the experience of essentially the great mystery comes knocking. I give her the name Sophia. So Sophia comes knocking. And you kind of ignore it for a little while, and then things start to happen that you say, I don't think I can ignore this. And for you, it's so interesting that there were these clear images, these powerful dreams, highly charged, and the sp very specific six-pointed star and this woman, and then to encounter her. And then similarly, going, so then it's kind of almost pulling you in, and you go to see these witches because of other synchronicities, and then things happen there, and then this evidence, and in part it came as career evidence, right? Because suddenly your career moved. It was interesting. I was surprised to find out that you were managing bands as part of. So I liked that you were doing union law because my grandfather was a coal miner, big in the unions, and so I thought this is great. This is my kind of gal. She's into the magic. She's into the unions. But you couldn't make a living very easily, and then it turned out that one of the things that happened, not only do you see this image from a dream, which has got to be, I mean, that's a powerful kind of synchronicity, and when Jung tells, just as a little aside, because I think some people have heard me say this before, but when Jung gives the kind of iconic example for him of a synchronicity, it is with a woman who was, he said, very rationalistically trained. And the therapy was stuck, and he said, "Well, the unconscious will find a way." And for him, then I think the high bar of synchronicity is that it leads to a transformation, because there's one thing to say there's a meaningful coincidence, and yes, that's great. But if nothing really happens in your life, I think Jung would say, "Yeah, that's a little bit lesser of a synchronicity." But if you suddenly say, "Oh my goodness," and your life moves in a different direction, that is part of the magic, in a way. And so, I don't know. Maybe you can reflect on some of that early evidence, because you were trying to be very practical, and yet you were seeing, but something is working in my life, and I can't ignore the fact that it functions.
Right. Though I'm deeply grateful to all of it, because it understood who I was more than I understood. And so I was blessed with confirmation that my rational mind required. And it's funny that you talk about Jungian synchronicity, because the thing that I always wear when I'm teaching or doing my consultations or is this golden scarab, which was a gift to me from a friend many
There it
years ago.
is. There it is.
And it was this the appearance of this beetle, right? While he was engaged in the therapy with this woman, that synchronicity, the concept of the synchronicity. And
So this woman
voila.
dreamed of a scarab. For those of you who don't know the story, this is the moment where she's sharing a dream when Jung had thought, I can't do anything else. Let the unconscious do its magic. We could say, let the soul do its magic. She dreams of a scarab, a golden scarab, which Phyllis is wearing. So it's beautiful. Wonderful. Yes. And this really shifted her. She couldn't help but be confronted with, I dreamed of something, and here it is in real life in an impossible way.
It flew into the office as the, at this moment of like impasse or and the dream, the recounting of the dream, and the beetle flies in Vienna. This beetle flies into the window through the window while they're having a go. So, and that was it, right? He recognized the synchronicity. She recognized the magic that was unfolding, and the transformation began. And I always say that the first thing magic changes is you. There's so much to unpack in this wonderful. I've been really looking forward to this conversation with you. And you're so marvelous and adept. I mean, I've listened to several of these fantastic conversations that you've had, and including with academics and the one about thinking with nature. I was almost done with that. I was listening to it before we began. There's so much to talk about. It's so rich, and it's so rare to have somebody with whom one can have these kinds of conversations. So, I mean, the blessing of the path that unfolded for me were the confirmations, the signs, the synchronicities, the experiences, the things that unfolded, including this astonishing manifestation that you'd be a fool, right? A fool's errand to go and be, go meet with witches every week. I mean, what could be crazier, right? I mean, now, no, because now it's the hippest thing on the block. But then, demented, impossible, ridiculous, completely. And yet, for that to seem, incontrovertible, I mean, just clearly the place where the truth was pointing, right? And where truth lay. And that truth lay with people about whom great lies, in the tradition of psychopaths and sociopaths and right, those infatuated with power and more than willing to employ violence to secure it and to maintain it, the great lie of witches, that they were evil, that they worshipped Satan, that they killed babies, all the things that were said about the Jews during the Inquisition, then visited upon the heads of primarily women, but also others, some of whom were indeed practitioners of the old way. The word witch, witch, doesn't appear until the 1600s in England, and it's a change in the original spelling, which is WICCE in the feminine, witcha, and the masculine, WICCA, which is a 5,500 year now, 5,500 year old word from the Proto-Indo-European. So when you're talking 5,500 years ago, you're talking shamanism.
Yeah, and it's interesting that in that Proto-Indo-European, just changing one letter, the first C to a G, and so it must have sounded similar in people's ears, but that was a person skilled in horses.
I didn't know that.
So there might have been some resonance there for that people, for those speakers. I don't know for sure, obviously, but the horse is such a magical, obviously the shaman's drum and the horse hooves go together, and this is the vehicle. So there's a deep intimacy there, horses and magic and the liminal.
Yes, and the shaman's drum in other indigenous traditions, as you just said, is referred to as the shaman's horse.
That's right, yep.
It's the means by which we ride into expanded realms, into realms of spirit. And I've noticed the horse is like, oh, he's a power animal. I mean, there's some debate still about the etymology of the word, but it's becoming clear. There's always resistance, you know, when words redefine themselves and you, right? And the transformation begins, and there's resistance to that. But it meant wise one. People say, oh, wicker means bending. Well, that's no, this is, you know, much later we start to get into these sort of patriarchal ideas of magic as the means of bending and manipulating reality. Secondary. The point is not the bending and the control over forces of nature. It's just an extension, you know, of what we do now, right? With our technology, with our scientific technologies. The idea that magic is a means of controlling things, to me, is a, you know, it's the same thing. It's just, you know, it's in a different realm. The reality of magic is epiphanal. It's communal. It's that experience of intimate connection, and the changes then that start to flow from that encounter and revelation and participation. And when I began the use of ecstatic practices to alter consciousness, to open consciousness, to expand consciousness, I wasn't really big on the use of medicine plants, which are always a part of the traditions, including in Greece, with ergot, about which I was quite interested, but not interested in practicing because I was a lawyer, and I was still a social justice lawyer for, you know, so I was not going to mess around with stuff that was illegal at the time. But there are other mechanics for opening perception, chanting, dancing, ritual, the casting of, you know, the things that indigenous peoples do that begin to shift and alter your consciousness. And then, of course, I found the shamanic work with the use of drumming and journeying, that's referred to as journeying. And I spent 20 years becoming skilled at moving. Of altering consciousness and moving into realms of spirit for guidance and insight. That's how we created with the artist that worked with me, Danielle Barlow, who knew how to journey, and was wonderful. It was great to be able to work with somebody instead of dictating to her, you know, this is what I saw. It's like, what did you see when you journeyed? What did I see when we journeyed? And okay. And here even is the truth that we were asked to share with the world. After about 20 years, I began to realize that as amazing, extraordinary, and important it as it is for us to be able to expand and move into realms of spirit, and in fact, to be able to move outside the limits of space and time, with remarkable efficacy and value. And one of the greatest gifts that I was receiving, that I was overlooking because I'm still a fish swimming in the water of my culture, but I was sort of awakened, and it's a longer conversation, but I was awakened to the gift that I was being given, which was the gift of seeing the sacred, not just in realms of spirit, but in this world, embodied by this world, to begin to recognize what was right in front of all of us, but that we had been unable to see, and to realize that the techniques, the practices, and that's what I loved about it. It wasn't a belief system. Nobody was asking me to believe in anything. These are spiritual practices. If you work them, they will work. And they take off, but they help you take off the blindfold. To see the mystery that's just hiding in plain sight. It's the delusion of our consciousness and our failure to operate the machinery properly that has kept us blinded to the reality within which we're blessed to live. And I began to realize that spirit and world really are one, right? That it's, you know, what is light? Is it a wave or a particle, right? Is it energy or a form? It's like, yes. So what is the divine? Is it energy or embodiment? The answer is yes. It's not one or the other. It's kind of, you know, it's fluxing back and forth between the two. You know, matter is energy. So, you know, oh, and it's energy of a very particular sort. And gradually, I began to recognize and to come into this kind of deep humility and gratitude and curiosity. And I was given another epiphany and it's kind of a download. And then I spent quite a bit of time trying to figure out, you know, when you get a download, is it real or is it not real? Is it true or is it not true? And so, of course, I, you know, start reading all this environmental stuff. And finally, I got an affirmation from a biologist. Yes, indeed, nature's magic. She called it nature's secret magic. It was articulated, Janine Benrus.
Oh, Benrus, yeah. Biomimicry, yeah.
Right, and the more she does the work, the more she starts, it has been getting more into indigenous and the ethic. But 10 years ago, almost 20 now, the way she articulated it in this TED talk that I came across years after my epiphany was this, what exactly what I was told, that all living things and all the systems that support them, but all living things live according to an essential organizing principle that they know, that is encoded in their DNA by everything. The bacteria in my gut, my foxy who's sleeping behind me, for those who can see, her sleeping on her pillow, the trees outside my window, every living thing lives according to this principle that is embedded, encoded in their DNA of how to live as a healthy bacteria in my gut, as Foxy the cairn carrier, as the oak tree. They know how to live according to their nature, to be healthy and, in fact, to be happy, right? Because those, they go together. And the net effect of that instinctive behavior, that encoded wisdom, that way of living, which results in health and happiness, is that they contribute to the well-being of the world in which they live. They make the world better for all life. Benrus uses the word conducive, that they contribute to create the creation of healthy air, healthy water, healthy soil, healthy temperature, blah, 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 blah. That natural behavior is not just good for the living being that's engaged in that way of living, but then is also making the world better for all life. And that came to me as a revelation after a long pursuit of the green man around the world, literally. Came home, was very sick, and heard the mother speaking to me. And it took years before I fully integrated it or understood it or could articulate it, not from words in my head, but from a truth that I had begun to embody or to at least attempt to embody and to recognize in the world around me. It's a moral principle, right? Profoundly, I mean, it's a moral compass. It doesn't set our well-being against the well-being of creation. It sees the two as intimately interconnected, that our well-being, when properly pursued in a natural way, and what that is, we have a lot of work to rediscover, right? Because we've become so unnatural. And so, I mean, so the lessons there, I think they're there for us. They're all around us. It is through attending to how nature does things, right, that we can begin to retrieve our own natural wisdom. And there are, once again, there are practices like breathing with trees that the trees gave me that pulled me out of a long sorrow. And as I realized how damaged we were and how devastating the damage that we've done to the planet is, and how impotent I felt in the face of that one tiny little person. The trees just pulled me right out and spoke and showed me how to breathe and showed me the thing that was the mystery hiding in plain sight. The simple fact that every breath we take, I used to say without fully understanding it, I think it was my second book, that the divine is a breath away, right? The divine is a breath away. So, you know, you breathe, the breath meditation, it's everywhere now. We talk about it in terms of calming and productivity, but right, it's a lot more than that. But the trees were like, really, it's very nice that you do all these gestures and gesticulations and invoking of the East and, you know, making incenses and all these things that you do. But honestly, you just need to breathe with us and pay attention to what's happening when you're breathing. What? And it was the first thing I was told in pulling me out of my long, deep sorrow was breathe. And I was able to breathe to a place of quiet. And in that quiet, then it was the trees that I heard, and they were laughing. And they were laughing at me, but then they were laughing with me. And they were just pay attention and breathe with us. And I began to feel and experience, and then to realize that as I was inhaling, I was receiving the breath of life that they were creating for me. And that as I was exhaling, there was waste. I had been taught, you know, exhale the tension, exhale your negative, you know, the garbage of the, and the trees like, just don't stop. Stop doing that. There's no waste in nature. Just exhale. And I realized as I was doing it, I felt it being received and valued and enjoyed and being appreciated, that my body was creating the breath of life for the plants. And that every breath that I was engaged in was an exchange of life, a breath of life, that we were giving this gift to each other, that in doing this thing about which I was pretty unconscious, constantly, I was constantly receiving a blessing and returning it. And that reciprocity was the dynamic, right? An essential dynamic of how everything is working. There's this exchange of energies that's going on all the time in order to sustain life, to create life. And we're enmeshed in it. We're never alone. Spirits are always with us, but everything living is always with us, participating with us. Some things very intimately, like the plants, others maybe a little further away. But this idea was no longer an idea. It was a breathed, inhaled, exhaled truth that I was enmeshed in a world full of magic, of nature's magic, that all living things know how to take care of themselves naturally, to be healthy and to be happy, the consequence of which is that they make the world better for all life. And I was like, okay, so I'm in. I have no idea how to do that as a human, and I want to learn. I want to learn. So that's where I am.
Yeah.
And I'm just let people know. Turns out there's an organizing principle. It's been confirmed by some of our finest naturalists, our biologists, that in fact there is an organizing principle at the heart of creation. And it's a profound spiritual and ethical principle. And it is as close as the next breath you take. if you do it, is if you bring your attention to the reality of the relationship that you're engaged in and what is actually happening. And it's not, it's utterly simple and it's life changing. It changes your point of view and your posture. I don't know. I think there's a lot of talk about, I hear lots and lots of talk about ego. It tends to be more a conversation that men need to have. Women, because we have estrogen, I think, although there's a lot of ego still, but it's not so much of an issue. So whatever work needs to get done, good, should be done. But the means of seeing the sacred are not complicated. And there are those, you know, in academia and in the halls of power and in the great mosques and temples and churches of the world who would argue my capacity to know the truth of my experience. And then I would simply, you know, take them outside and sit them by a tree and have them breathe and see what happens.
Mm. Well, that's where Buddha started as well, in teaching what he called the direct path. I mean, there's a lot of resonance with what you're saying in the way philosophy is looked at in ancient dominant culture roots, but also in other places. So Buddha referred to his philosophy using the word ehipasiko, which means come and see. So he said, I teach a come and see thing. It's not a matter of belief, but you have to find out for yourself. And when he taught the direct path, what he called the direct path to enlightenment, it begins, that is the path of mindfulness, and it begins with mindfulness of the body, and importantly, mindfulness of the breathing. It's interesting that these traditions, they really emphasize that there are stages of learning. I call them the three R's and the two E's. First, you receive a teaching, and if you understood the words, that's all there is to it. But if you said, wait, I didn't hear what that word was, what does that mean? That's the basic level of clarification. Then you reflect, which means critical thinking. Like, now, wait, does this really hold up? And that's where you have to use what we sometimes think of as reason in a limited sense, because you have to challenge the teacher and say, no, wait, that doesn't make any sense, really, when you think it through. Then you have to run the experiment. So the two E's are experimentation and experience. There has to be direct experience. And as that happens, it opens up insights that bring you back to the first two stages again. Then finally, you come to what is referred to as realization, the final R. That's where the fruits are there. And you move from understanding to wonderstanding. You really get it in a different way. And it's interesting because in your book, even, you talk about breathing. And really, the outlines of what you're saying in the book are no different than what you said now, but you spiraled back, as we do, because we spiral back and we say, oh, that's what it means. And it's very much like that. And so, because obviously, if I just sit and breathe, I'm not Buddha. But at some point, somebody, you know, as the tradition continued, thousands of people spun back around to breathing and said, oh my gosh, the guy was right. You know, what? Well, I thought I was just breathing. And then there's something really magical that you find. And it makes a difference, because a lot of times some of these things that we say, oh, you know, go out and breathe, it sounds so simplistic. And people don't realize that it has to change us. You talked about these, I refer to them as arts of awareness, but how we do need to train. You are yourself, you are reality. And what those very highfalutin people are just trying to say is, well, have you trained your mind enough for me to trust that you really have done the experiments? Have you done the work? Because you can't just, I mean, everybody's breathing right now. If you got enlightened while we were talking about this, please let me know. If you did, great, you should come on the podcast next. But generally, we have to make this transformation. And you, as you point out, it's interesting because it's so important that, for me, a central message of philosophy is the non-duality of spiritual and ecological reality and the necessity that all our activity furthers the conditions of life, that it cultivates the whole of life onward. But you, as with many of us, we're trapped in ways of living, styles, a lifestyle and a livelihood that can be so divorced from that. So 80% of the biodiversity on the planet is under the care of 5% of the population, which is the indigenous people. So indigenous people are only 5% of the population. 80% of the biodiversity is under their care. Here on Turtle Island, when people came here 500 years ago, in Europe, people thought they were lying when they heard the stories about the abundance of life here. Flocks of birds that blocked out the sun. Salmon runs that you could hear 2 miles away. You couldn't put a boat in the water. And where did it go? These people, the people who lived here where I live now, they thrived for thousands and thousands of years. We were here for a couple of centuries and it's gone. And so the life that you describe as an attorney, when you were able to see how people were living, it was with that radical disconnection that people were taking from the earth, and that activity at the high level where people are going, they're having caviar and champagne and doing whatever they want. It is this bizarre act of will against the grain of life. And we're kind of all in that space, even if we don't see it, right? We're having to rethink, wait a minute, what are we really? And you're pointing to magic and to Wicca, and I would say generally to these wisdom traditions as a way to find out, really, what are you? What is this mind? And how do you use it in attunement with the world you live in? Because we don't know how to use it. As you said, there's a fundamental thing. We're told to use your head. But how? And the way we're taught is usually not conducive to the conditions of life.
And, I mean, we're infatuated with rational minds, right? The Enlightenment was a blessing in many ways. But it's... Of course, everything breaks if half of everything is missing, right? And we've relied solely on one aspect of our capacities. And then, of course, all the things that contribute to, you know, the Western model has been one of, as soon as we sent God away, right? As soon as God left the building, we jumped the rails. At the minute that we started to think of the divine as elsewhere, you know, and of having to leave the world behind in order to return to reunion with him. And as soon as we started to characterize the planet as inert or evil or less than or ours, you know, or for our pleasure and our well-being with virtually complete indifference to the that's the irony, is we have acted without regard for the consequences of our actions. Mm-hmm. We have cared only about ourselves and our well-being. And the irony is that our well-being cannot exist outside the framework of the well-being of the whole. And because we did that, we're destroying the whole, which will lead inevitably to our own destruction. The tragedy, of course, I mean, if we can't figure out how to do it properly, we shouldn't be here. We don't deserve to be here. We can't be here because right? The tragedy.
That's why Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos are going to take us into space, because we can't be here. It's an amazing thing. Instead of trying to figure out how to live here where we have grass and trees and everything else, and there are other physicists too just dreaming of this, let's make wormholes where planets where we don't know if our microbiome is going to work. I mean, we might step into those planets and just be dead. And yeah. We've got a planet that works and we don't want to fix it.
They're insane, they're psychopathic, they're sociopathic, honestly. And we've created, over 5,000 years, we've created a system of chutes and ladders. We shoot the crazy ones right to the top, right? That's what we do. We put the guys with the biggest egos and the biggest manias. They may be smart, but they're phenomenally stupid. And they're driven, and they're driven by all the wrong things. And we reward them, you know? And here we are. So yeah, no, they're out of their minds. And the problem is also, you know, AI and everything else, we're living we're living in the end game of patriarchy, and where those who are in power, who love power and the wealth and the comfort and the reassurance that it gives them, and the fragility of their egos, or are also able to have profound power over the minds and the thinking, right? And the lack of thinking of millions of people. And we live, it's 1984 on steroids, right? It's
We don't
extreme.
realize it. That's part of what's so subtle is that it works. It works even as we sit there skeptical of it. It's like it's working in spite of, it's a strange efficacy that it has. And so much of it, of course, is invisible. But even the parts where we, something in us is saying they're lying, we're believing it at the same time. We've really gotten a psychotic break.
Yes. But so the question is, I think, right? Do we have time to heal what we've broken? And witches have always been healers. And I think that's one of the reasons that there is this massive fascination with witchcraft. There are lots of things that can contribute to it. Women have been powerless. It's a way of regaining their power. There are people who, grab onto it as the icon of the ultimate rebel. So there are lots of reasons why people are drawn to it. There's a lack of power, and so it's perceived as a source of power, with a misunderstanding of what the power is that you're actually working. But underneath all of that, I think the real call is a summoning by the sacred embodied by the planet itself, that the world needs her witches, that she needs the wise ones, that she needs the ones who remember and who know how to remember, the ones who know by virtue of experience, right? Who are able to use the sacred technologies and not believe, but experience through personal revelation and the responsibility that comes with it, but also the power that comes with it, because you are empowered by creation, because you're re-enmeshing in it. And the thing that gives me hope, right, is that the technology, the spiritual technologies, actually work. They do take off the blindfold, and you see and you experience, and it changes you. And you feel yourself enmeshed, and you feel yourself nourished, and you feel yourself blessed, and you feel yourself loved, and you want to give back. You want to. We all have to be incredibly forgiving of ourselves and patient with ourselves, because we're enmeshed in a society that's been created over 5,000 years that is entirely the opposite, right? It's completely unnatural, and yet it works, right? We all have cars and cashmere and caviar if you want, if you can afford it, and right. So it's very difficult to extricate yourself from all of the mechanisms of reward and destruction, of extraction, devastation. It's almost impossible. But it is very, very possible for us to continuously, every day, to begin to engage in new models of interaction and connection and mutuality and gratitude, and to begin to gently, slowly, step by step, change and shift and make choices and take actions that are less destructive and more protective. And small actions taken by vast numbers of people add up to a big effect. The pandemic showed us sh things shut down for a year, and there was a, what was it, a 6% drop in pollution, just by slowing our roll. The first thing that is necessary, though, is the opening, right? Is the opening of consciousness. And the enabling of our capacities to see. The question of becoming instinctual again, of rediscovering the blueprint inside of ourselves that would enable us to live within the web in ways that make us healthy and happy and that contribute to the well-being of the entire planet. That's the challenge for us, right? But the first thing is to understand the principle and to experience it embodied, and that's through the breathing. And I was sort of blessed and given these practices that worked for me, and that when I teach them to other people, and they're just unbelievably simple, and the experience that people have is like seeing the Libyan Sybil materialize. It's a personal experience of revelation and connection. And it's a blessing experience. And it evokes this desire to reciprocate, to give back, this recognition that in fact you are, right? That you have a capacity to instinctively act in a life-protective, life-enhancing way that is in fact contributing to the well-being of other living beings. But that's it is a part of you. And then we have our work to do about how we create social structures and education systems and economic situations and energy, consumption, how do we run the machines with energy that does not devastate and destroy? And so we all have a role to play in rediscovering how we're supposed to come home and live here. I don't know if we're going to have time to do it. I do know that species evolve when their survival depends upon it, and our survival depends upon it. Learning how to operate the machinery properly in a way that returns us into this intimate and reciprocal relationship with creation. And it is not difficult.
But it is an education. I mean, it's interesting because your process of, because you were talking, among other things, this sense of the interwovenness. For one thing, it definitely brings to mind Gregory Bateson's work, that he really encouraged us to embrace the sense of aesthetic unity that so many wisdom traditions offer us. The aesthetic playing a role in our epistemology, our way of knowing. And this is an atheistic scientist, who himself, he really wasn't, I mean, he was a kind of non-woo person, but he preferred hanging out at Esalen than he did hanging out with other scientists, because those people had that sense of aesthetic unity that he really felt was there and was important. But it still is a practice to arrive at it, to arrive. So when you were talking about that feeling of connectedness, it certainly reminded me of the way the circle is cast and the way you have to relearn, which means don't go off on your own and try to reinvent the wheel. There are traditions that can teach you what ritual really is, what its meaning is, what its power is, what magic really is, what connection really is, what communion, why sisterhood is important, or brotherhood, or whatever your sangha or your community is. Why is it important, and how do you build it? How do you navigate? How do you learn? And I love that you're saying, of course, memory, because Plato thought the soul knows all this stuff and we're just remembering. And Buddha's word that we translate as mindfulness, sati, has the connotation of memory, that you're remembering, wait, I'm here for a reason. And you're remembering yourself. You're remembering that this life is fleeting, and remembering that there are potentials that you're losing track of all the time. But that educational path is centrally also what you see a priestess as, an educator. And that's what a philosopher is, too. Also, physicians. Buddha is this great physician who gives the diagnosis, gives you the cause of it, the etiology, and gives you a prescription for how you heal it. And we can. And the beauty... Yeah, and the beauty is, what I often tell people is, we're going to have to change one way or another if we begin to learn again what how to use our mind, how to use the world, how to be in good relation with ourselves, each other, and the world. Then we could avert catastrophe. But if the catastrophe still comes, at least you'll have the kind of mind better able to face that because you can see this in people who were trained, like with the Tibetans who were captured by the Chinese during the invasion and tortured and put in prison, and the low levels of trauma. Whereas for most of us, under those same circumstances, we really would have experienced high levels of trauma. The people who learned how to use the mind, they didn't experience that. And it's important, I think, for us to know how powerful all these traditions are.
I think that's very true. And the only thing I would begin to, I would articulate somewhat differently is that I think part of the work is to allow the wisdom of the body to instruct the mind, to allow the wisdom of the heart to instruct the mind, to allow the wisdom of spirit embodied by creation to instruct the mind. And that's a part of our work, that there's a limit to what the mind can know until it comes into relationship with where it is. We've tended towards the abstract always, right? Or the transcendent. And the irony is that it's imminent, right? So the story of Moses, and he wants to see God, and he gets to see God, and he's blinded. Or Eros and Psyche, right? And that, you can't see me because if you see me, you'll go blind. And I keep thinking, no, that's just wrong. sorry, judgment? Yes, it is wrong. That it's seeing the sacred that will heal our blindness. And the sacred is embodied by the butterfly in the tree and my dog and the worm in the ground, looking so carefully that we begin to see not just the little squirmy thing, but what the little squirmy thing is doing and how the little squirmy thing is aerating the soil and helping to reconstitute the elements that are then used to nourish life and how life grows out of the air. Look closely, pay attention. That was, I was asked over and over again 25 years ago when I wrote my first book, and I was super public suddenly. And, what is a witch? Well, a witch is the person who pays attention, who pays very, very, very careful attention to the presence of the sacred that is revealing itself to us in creation, by creation, as creation. And so when we watch the body, when we attend to the wisdom of the body, of the sacred, engaged in life, the mind begins to heal, begins to recognize where it is, begins to recognize how it's dependent upon this unfolding beauty and wisdom, and begins to learn how to live. And, when you look at nature, it makes things that are weird. and crocodiles kind of freak me out. Snakes can make me a little nervous, especially if they hiss and they have fangs. And I'm not mad for pandemics, but by and large, it's all pretty gorgeous. Nature doesn't really makes things that are weird, but by and large, everything is magnificently beautiful, just beautiful. And we have an instinct to go to nature to rest for a vacation, right? People pay the most money to go to the most pristine places where they can be the most alone and catered to, right? But we know instinctively that we need to be in the nature. To be in nature heals us. We become more natural. We become better humans in the natural world. We experience awe which is biochemical in its transformative impact on us. Our cortisol levels drop, our stress levels drop. Our ego begins to quiet. We become more altruistic. People will risk their lives to save strangers in the natural world. We become better. Our human nature becomes better when we enmesh, when we go into nature, and rather than attempt to control, extract, or abuse it, we allow ourselves to be still and in attendance with it and let it make its magic on us. We start to change. So I think and then add to that the spiritual technologies and the utter simplicity of them. That's the thing. They're simple. They're not complicated. They're not big, long, elaborate rituals with lots of moving parts and crazy costumes and weird hats and long liturgies. I mean, you know, they're simple. They're always simple. Wherever you go in the globe, the old ways work. And if you work them, they will work and they will change you. The first thing magic changes is you. So what is magic? It's that revelation of the divine in a dream, in a synchronicity, in a tree, right? In your dog, in the eyes of a beloved, and that love, and in that the wonder as you begin to discover that the way everything is organized is to assure the well-being of all the participants, and that all the participants are instinctively contributing to the well-being of all. I can imagine no greater proof of the existence of the, all right, this is always the thing. You can't prove the existence of God. I'm like, oh no, yeah. Like, look out your window.
Right, yeah. Well, there's also, yeah. I mean, we're not necessarily disagreeing. I would say that when we think of the so-called wisdom of the body, whatever that is, that is mind. The thing that we refer to as mind is actually an abstraction and is only some sort of figment. And the thing that we refer to as body actually is an abstraction at first. We have to find out what that is. The thing we refer to as nature is an abstraction. People had nature. When people, the conquest culture came here, there was more nature than they knew what to do with, and they just got rid of it all. Just being in it, they had to live in it. And Buddha also talks about that. He says, look, any idiot can go into the woods. They're not going to be enlightened. When I went into the woods, because that's the gold standard of knowing in that tradition, is you go off to the wilderness. And he said, but I went with a mind of love. I went with a mind of peace. He went with this awareness. And so the things go totally together. It's that, okay, if you go and you really begin to work with your mind all together, because one of the things that there, since that was the kind of gold standard, there's even a story of one fellow who used to go off all the time by himself into the woods. And the other students of Buddha said, it's not going very well with this guy, you know? So they went and they told Buddha, said, this guy, he's just always off by himself, you know? We try to help him. We try, come meditate with us, you know, a little bit. No, he doesn't want to do it. So Buddha says, well, bring him to me. So they say, Buddha wants to see you. And he says, okay, all right. And Buddha says, what are you doing? Well, I'm going off by myself in the woods, you know, going out to be with nature. And he said, who told you to do that? And he said, well, that's what you did. He said, yeah, but when you go, you're not alone. I went by myself and I was just there with the world. It's just me and the world. And then everything was there with me. But you're not alone enough for everything to be there with you. You're taking all your stuff. And a lot of it is unconscious. And we don't know that we're doing it because we've got no idea what a clear mind is. And that's part of, I'm just trying to actually not disagree with you, but honor the story that I read about a person who learned how to work with her mind and learned and that went together with the relationship with nature, right? And just saying, well, they're nothing separate. Whenever I think of the body's wisdom, that's just, that must be awareness. It must be the primordial mind is there too.
Yeah, I think that, I'm no disagreement there. I think there are many paths, right? For me, the epiphany was given at a moment of not love, but of grief and sorrow and despair. After a long, long period of disorientation and sorrow. And there was a bit of, listen, you know, you're not useful to me like this. There was a little of that. And there was this, that it, what am I trying to say? That I was not entering the natural world with love. The natural world entered me with love.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
That I'm broken and despairing. I had relinquished everything that I thought I knew and been given this epiphany, and then looked and said, we are broken beyond repair, and we have broken things beyond repair. And I am, you know, like when Dorothy goes to see them, you know, I am, you know, Dorothy, the small and meek, right? There's nothing I can do. I'm overwhelmed. And in that state of emptiness, the world blessed me with its love and its wisdom and its consciousness, if you wish, and brought me back to life. So I think there are many ways to come into the presence of, to experience revelation and connection, and to be drawn back into relationship and to begin the journey home.
Mm-hmm. It's very much like the Socratic aporia. I mean, that's what Socrates was trying to get people to. To just get to the place where you say, I don't know where to go from here. And everybody wants to escape usually at that moment. But there too, I think your background gave you all that learning you had done up to that point gave you the willingness to stay in that uncomfortable place of not knowing. And then that which can make a way where no way is possible, right? I mean, Martin Luther King Jr. was referring, I think, to that aporia. There is this force in the universe that can make a way where we don't see a way, if we'll stay. And you stayed open. That's a beautiful thing. And that's so encouraging. I mean, part of what I want to encourage people is, you know, if you don't have a tradition, read Phyllis's book and think of Wicca as there's guidance and there's community. And there's brotherhood, but there's also sisterhood, right? I mean, there are groups of men who are engaged in these practices. There are mixed groups, but I'm just trying to say that this is a beautiful way to say, hey, if you're feeling overwhelmed about the state of the culture, about the political circus, the economic inequality, the injustice, the ecological degradation, you're not much use to the world if you just continue to feel terrible. And there might be ways forward if you can stay open.
I am grateful to you to say that, for saying it so perfectly. And that's the great truth, that we are not, that we're not alone, that we are enmeshed, and that we are enmeshed in a living, breathing, profoundly loving, deeply sacred web of life. In which we're meant to play a role. I continue to wonder what our role is. My dog knows her role. You know, put her in the garden and show her a weasel or a squirrel and she's on it. She knows exactly, you know, her job. I do not know what our job is. Sometimes I think it's art and music, right? And contributing to the creation of beauty and contributing to the harmony and the well-being. And we have to find the way in which we are uniquely equipped to play our role, what that role is. And we don't know what it is. You know, the way we've been doing it is not the role. We've been doing opposite role. So we have a lot to learn, but I feel very confident that you know, if you work the practices, they will work. And they will open us in the ways that our awareness needs to be opened into the mystery that is hiding in plain sight and is happy to show us. The last thing because I know our time is coming to the end, but there was a moment in 2014 when I was sitting on the stage at Morehouse College being inducted into the Martin Luther King, since you invoked him. The story with which we began kind of doesn't really conclude. It's just like it marks the next chapter. And I was sitting on this stage in the spotlights and had no family. My mother had died. My marriage had ended. I never had the children I had hoped to have. My community was somewhat scattered. I was in this period of sorrowing after this revelation and et cetera. I'm sitting on the stage thinking, I don't belong here. You know, I've done absolutely nothing to warrant, you know, receiving an honor. It's, you know, makes no sense to me. I have no one to share it with, and I don't understand why it's happening. I mean, I'm grateful, but I don't think I belong here. I have not accomplished the smallest fraction of what would deserve an honor. And when it was over, I packed my little suitcase and had about 2 hours before I needed to get to the airport. And so I was like, to the cab driver, take me to a museum. So he took me to a museum. I stored my luggage. I start walking around. I have no idea where I am. And I suddenly had this feeling that I hadn't had in a long time of being pulled. And I walk across this sort of suspended walkway over an atrium. And I feel myself being drawn. I get across to the other side. There's another portion of the museum. I turn right. I look down this long hallway. And at the end of the hallway in a spotlight is the Libyan symbol. At this point, I knew about Sojourner Truth, and I knew about the source of the inspiration. For a long time, she had simply been the prophetic priestess of the goddess Isis, the queen of magic, and the one who brings life back to the world. And there she was.
Is this in the same location?
Same. No, different museum. Atlanta. Sorry, I was in Atlanta.
Wow. So.
How is this possible? She's in New York. She can't be here. No, she's there. It was the smaller version that he had done first, to give you the logical explanation. Because sculptors, before working in a massive piece of marble, would do these smaller pieces. There she was. And I went and I sat with her. And I realized she was appearing not because I was done or because I had received a reward, you know, or an acknowledgement that I deserved. She was there to tell me the next part of the journey was now beginning. The next part of the work. The next part of learning and sharing was now to begin. And it did. And it did. Went back to work and I started sharing what I knew. And you put it really well. I love talking with you. I would love to do more. It's rare to find a kindred soul with such harmony. And yet, you know, the slightly different angle, which was one of the things that I loved about being in circle, you know, that when you put us all together, the truth appeared, that we want a little piece of it.
Yeah, that's the ecology of mind. Yeah, and it needs diversity to thrive. And thank you for joining us. Your continuation day is coming up soon, isn't it? Or your birthday, as people say, birthday.
It is.
Yeah, my mother was an Aquarian, so this is, and that's another hidden symbol of the goddess, isn't it? The birthday cake is Artemis with the candles on it, the round shape. It's the full moon. A lot of people don't know that they are really honoring the moon goddess when they give somebody a birthday cake with candles on it.
This is the thing that I love about doing this work, is the opportunity to rediscover. People are hungry, right, for the way home, the path home. And the thing that I am so grateful for is to discover that we have our own, that we don't need to appropriate you know, another culture's wisdom tradition, that in fact we have our own, and that as we retrieve it, you know, we start to heal that original wound of separation from the sacred and from the earth itself and from the feminine and from our magic. And we need to do that. I hope you call us the people of fire, right? And too much fire will destroy the world, but fire in the right measure is joy. Yeah, so we are the people of joy. We just have to find that joy path. And it's right there. It's right there. Mm. And I appreciate you recommending this particular path home. It's been very meaningful. And I found that everybody's path is quite unique, no question. And that's one of the wonderful things about the practice, is because it allows you the unique experience of a divinity that is particularly compelling for you, or right, has the wisdom of your way. But we're all walking in the same sacred landscape. So we're never alone. The guidance is always there. You just have to pay attention.
Yeah, and I think that's even another reason. Just as a philosopher, I really appreciated reading Book of Shadows as a sense of someone expressing being on the same path, but just, okay, where it's the same path and not the same path at the same time, and that's good, that's great, but you can recognize so much of the resonance. And I think whatever your tradition, or if you're just curious, or if you are a practicing Buddhist, or whatever you are, practicing Jew, just whatever, I think you recognize things in your tradition and the way you talk about the sacred and the divine and talk about magic. I think they are informative and inspiring and give a sense of connectedness across traditions. So even if it's not something that a person's thinking, oh, Wicca might be for me, but then you have other books as well. And can you say the name of some of your, you have five other books, I don't know if you remember all five?
Well, the second one was Witchcrafting, which was sort of a companion volume for people who wanted to practice after they read the story of how an Ivy League witch and an Ivy League lawyer ends up being a witch. They wanted guidance in how to find the path themselves. So Witchcrafting is theology and very deconstructed, because I pulled out, with the shamanic influence, I pulled out a lot of the old sort of biblical stuff and the patriarchal stuff, and patriarchal ideas about magic as manipulation, things like that. So Witchcrafting was my second. And the third was The Love Spell, which is about love and the illusions of it, and then the reality of it and the magic of it. And in particular, you might appreciate, with your background as a philosopher, a wise one of the in the Greek way of the, I'm probably going to pronounce it wrong. I say it either a daimon or daemon, the daemon, and that masculine muse, that guiding spirit. So it's about the presence of that, beginning to recognize its role in your maturational journey towards real love and embodiment. And I would probably edit it and do it differently now. It's a little, it has some very erotic components in it. And it's good, right? I wrote another one called Wicca Made Easy, which is a very straightforward, also very practice oriented, but a little more mature, and includes a lot of work of shamanism, how we integrate essential core shamanic practice into the work that we do, and how it transforms the work and ourselves. I did a lovely little book called Spells for Living Well, which is a very radically different approach to the traditional idea of spell casting, and which people are valuing, and it's I think you might enjoy it. And I created a tarot deck using shamanic journeying, which radically alters the traditional sort of ceremonial magical approach to tarot decks, and is a very embodied deck. And it, instead of it being a deck that sort of teaches you to go up and out in order to encounter the divine, it's a deck that counsels going down and in and through into the world, into your life, into the natural world, in order to discover your spirit and the spirit of creation. It's very responsive. It I didn't know if it, I trusted the method by which we created it. The question was always what we need to know, and the answers were profound. And the presence of the numinous was right there as I was writing everything. And the illustrations are, we chose the moment in the journeys. It was a profound experience to create it, but we didn't know if it would work. Yeah, and it works. I should get the publisher to send you one. It's extraordinary. It's incredibly receptive.
Yeah, maybe we can have you back and talk about it. I'd love to look at it because I work with Yi Jing. I actually started working with tarot in my first attempt and was surprised at some of the things that it can empower you to know. And I do want to let people know this. I mean, if you've listened to me before, you understand that I have both a very deeply philosophical, like ancient wisdom tradition view, and also a scientific view of the importance of knowing in a better way. We need better ways of knowing ourselves in the world. And even from an informational perspective, as I often tell people, what we refer to as mind, the habitual mind, it's too small to know sufficiently. It's just a fact. It's just a matter of data transfer. You know, you're talking about a little old dial-up thing compared to this whole ecology of mind that knows things that the little conscious mind simply can't know. Everybody relies on it. It's not a question of, oh, this is some woo thing. As Phyllis tried to say, you can look at it as transcending the duality between the irrational and the rational. There's a non-rational or trans-rational that is not illogical or irrational, but it's also not merely the limited instrument of linear sequential thought. And we need that because we cannot capture the whole with a part. When we liberate ourselves into the whole and let the sacred do the knowing for us, then what we ourselves could not have known becomes knowable. And so that's what's so powerful then, that you created something using that, which in itself, so there's a recursion, in itself empowers that same activity to happen. That's the best way to have made it, using the activity that it itself is supposed to. So that's a powerful magic. And maybe we can talk a little bit about that next time.
So I said the great wisdom was in knowing not to bring what I thought I knew, but rather to use the processes by which one discovers what needs to be known and to, right?
Yeah.
How else to get an oracle but to use one?
Yeah. No, that's really wonderful. Well, that's fantastic. I look forward to that. If we can, we can talk after this and see if we can organize that. I want to thank you so much, Phyllis. Oh,
this was the card that came up for you.
It was. And is that a fox?
The fox.
Hello there, wisdom lovers. This is Dr. Nikos. I'm interjecting, interrupting, pausing. I've never done this before, but I wanted to acknowledge a real moment of magic that happened between a philosopher and a priestess. And I don't think it's clear enough without just a little bit of clarity about the context. So the first thing is, I want to make sure that the image is clear. For those of you who are able to watch the video, if you're watching the video, you can see, here's an image. It's an image of the tarot deck that Phyllis co-created and the card that she's showing me right now. I don't know if it was really clear in the video, but now it is. And for all of you, here's the deal. In preparing for the interview, I was still reading one of Phyllis's books right up until just a few minutes before the interview. She's written several books, and I was busy reading one of them, and there was something in that book that brought to mind a video that I had made, and I thought, you know, Phyllis might really like that video. And then I thought, oh, that's just silly. This was like a couple hours before the video, and I thought, she doesn't have time to watch a video, and I'm sure she's got other things going on, and then, you know, we're going to have this video. It's really short notice, and it's just some kind of impulse. And I went back to reading, and I got another page or two in and thought, you know what? This feels more like an inspiration than just an impulse. And we always have to discern the difference between those two. A lot of times the ego wants to convince us, this is an inspiration. You want chocolate cake. It's inspired, but it's just an impulse. And so I thought, well, maybe it isn't just an impulse. And I sent her a link for the video. And I can include that in the show notes if you want. And so she watched the video. And there are, she wrote me back just some very simple, it, her email said, "This was lovely, especially the foxes." I'm not sure why the foxes in particular drew her, but the foxes got added. The original thing was a collaboration between me and a jazz composer, and I felt that the video ended up being a little too moody in a dark way, maybe almost like, oh, this is kind of challenging, but not terribly challenging. And I thought, oh, I really want to have a lot of positivity, because ultimately the message is about our potential and our possibility. So the foxes got included in that addendum. And of course, they're great. But she could have picked anything in the video. And she could have just said, this was nice, but she didn't. She said, this was lovely, especially the foxes. Okay, so now, cut to our interview. So all that happened, even though I didn't even think she would watch the video, let alone respond to it. Then we began our interview, and before we started, Phyllis went, sort of just randomly chose a card from the tarot deck that she designed, and then she set it aside. She didn't reveal to me what the card was. She looked at it herself. She set it down, and I saw it there and saw the random selection. And so there's just this card, and I kind of even forgot about it. Now, then we open our dialogue, and you, if you had, unless you have forgotten or you're coming back to this later, we began with the question. She wanted to know, why would a philosopher want to interview a priestess? And I shared the story of Socrates and initiation and how he approached a priestess in order to be initiated into the mysteries of love, to learn about love in particular. And so now here we are at the end of our interview, and Phyllis decides to reveal the card that she randomly pulled from the tarot deck. And what card is it? It is love, card number 16, and it is an image of a woman and a fox. She sort of looks like a youngish woman. I'm not sure. She might be kind of an initiate herself, but maybe she's a priestess. And the little philosopher fox is there, and they're looking into each other's eyes. And fox is a spirit being, one of Sophia's special spirit beings, and so is butterfly. For the Greeks, one of the symbols of the soul, and there are two butterflies in the image as well. It's a rich image, and maybe we'll have a chance to talk to her if she can come back and discuss her tarot deck. And one of the things, there's a little booklet. One of the images shows that you could see if you're watching the video, shows the deck, the card box of the deck, the card, and then there's a little guidebook, a little booklet that helps you to understand the cards and how to read them. And one of the things that it says about the love card is, love is the greatest magic. And I think you need a little bit of that context to appreciate that this felt like a real moment of magic. And sometimes, you know, Sophia just winks. Sometimes the magic, it's like there's fireworks and explosions, and Sophia kind of grabs you and you can't help yourself. You're blown away. This was one of those little sugar pun fairies, you know, that dance in your head. And she's winking, and it felt really, really nice. And then afterwards, I just smiled so much, appreciating it, and also realizing that maybe you couldn't quite appreciate it as fully as I did without that clarity of context. And so, thank you. I hope that you did get a little bit of a cosmic chuckle out of that with me. And I return you to the final moments of my dialogue with Priestess Phyllis Curat. Phyllis had just written me an email with the word foxes in it before she pulled this card. So there's a synchronicity there because I had sent her an image that had foxes in it.
Yeah, that was it. And the foxes were, I was responding with the foxes in your very beautiful YouTube video.
Yeah.
That 13 things, yes. Well, thank you. I've enjoyed every minute of our time together. You've been very kind in allowing me to go. I don't know if I've been nearly as articulate as I would like to have been, but I'm very grateful for the opportunity and for those who listened. And I really will look forward to another conversation. It was a joy. Thank you for everything you're doing. And thank you for all the wonderful conversations that you are bringing into the world, because they're magical.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. And thanks to all of you listening. If you have any questions or reflections to share, or and especially questions, if we can get fellows back here, ask questions about the magical life and the mysteries, please send in whatever you've got through dangerouswisdom.org. We might be able to bring some of your questions, comments, and stories into a future contemplation. Until then, this is Dr. Nikos reminding you that your soul and the soul of the world are not two things. Take good care of them.